Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The XX GabFest is sponsored by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. Get a free trial and 10% off your first purchase when you visit squarespace.com and enter offer code XX, that's D-O-U-B-L-E-X. And by Harry's, the new shaving company that offers German-engineered blades, well-designed handles, and shipping right to your door, just in time for Valentine's Day. Save $15 and get the engraved Winston set for just $25 when you go to harrys.com and use the coupon code XXValentine. The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX GabFest for Thursday, January 22nd, the Raping Rape Culture edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a writer at Slate. I'm joined in the New York studios by June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hello, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah. So
did you guys watch the speech last night at all? No, you can admit it. David, really, he hates it. He begs me to turn it off after the first 5 minutes. And I'm like, you're supposed to care. We're important, educated people. You're supposed to care.
I read the New York Times about it this morning. But really, if my job doesn't require me to watch it, which it did for many years, I'm happy not to.
To skip it. I really just wanted to get to Joni Ernst and her speech and her big bright eyes and the bread bag shoes. She didn't mention castrating hogs, so I was slightly disappointed about that.
The lesbian Twitterverse was all a Twitter about her haircut. Apparently she stole it from the financial advisor. You know the one.
Anything I say might offend people. So.
Anyway, she has a lesbian haircut.
Only June, only you're allowed to continue this conversation with yourself while Noreen and I remain silent.
Okay,
let's jump into our topics. First, we're going to talk about a couple who let their kids walk home from the playground alone. They get in serious trouble and then become internationally famous. But will this make any difference in the habits of helicopter parents? Second, can you will yourself to fall in love? A recent Modern Love column says yes if you follow a certain trick. And three, Broad City, a Comedy Central show, posits a very specific kind of fantasy female utopia. Our first topic, free-range kids. A few weeks ago, a Maryland couple, Danielle and Alexander Maytive, got in serious trouble for letting their 10 and 6-year-old walk home from the playground alone. The police came to the door, Child Protective Services investigated, and they were all lectured on the creeps out there who might kidnap your children. As it happens, the couples are well-versed in the principles of free-range parenting, a movement that believes that children should be encouraged to be independent. So, are they right? We will discuss and then be joined by Dan Griffin, a child psychologist who has written on similar topics for Slate and happens to live exactly where the Métive kids were walking. So we're many years into this debate on helicopter parenting. I feel like we have this conversation. I wrote a story about it a year ago. People write about it. Why do you think this case got so much attention? Like, why was this the one that lit everyone up? June.
I think your piece kind of spelled it out, Hannah, your recent piece in Slate, that is. This is like the perfect test case. You know, this is like the case that you put together to go to the Supreme Court. These people are very educated. They're white, which, you know, does make a difference because we treat people of color and children of color differently than we do educated white people and the way they bring up their children. They are very, very like this is their cause. And they are very articulate in defending their cause and the way that they have sort of trained their children to be independent. They have a reason. It's not like they were unable to take care of their children because they are
working at the McDonald's,
exactly,
like Deborah Harrell.
Exactly.
Right.
Or because, you know, they're living in their car. Like it's a upper middle class family with advanced degrees and great jobs. And they have a really good rationale for why they're doing it. And so I think, you know, and it's a mile, which is more than just around the corner, you know, and it's Silver Spring, Maryland, which is right in the center of the Beltway media hub. I mean, it is a perfect test case.
And they are so damn articulate. Like when you read their quotes in The Washington Post or see them on TV, I mean, it's like It's amazing. It's like they are the spokespeople for the free range movement. They just express themselves absolutely rationally about how, you know, the dangers for kids have decreased and not increased, about how you have to teach your kids to be independent while worrying about safety. So the reaction to this case, Dan and I have discussed this, and I'll introduce Dan in a moment. It's a lot of libertarian outrage. Like what you see on Twitter is a lot of like, get those cops away from my door, right? So I think that's part of why it caused this big outrage. I mean, you can have like gun nuts in that mix and all sorts of people who think like cops coming to your door is like a huge intrusion into American society and family life. So that's part of it.
And as you said, Hannah, the Métis came from the Soviet Union, I believe. And so they have that kind of part of the story, too, you know, that they've come to America for freedom. And what? Our most basic freedom, the freedom to raise our children the way we see fit, is being restricted. You know, so they have, again, it's another great talking point that they're able to take full advantage of.
But people in the Soviet Union are like really intense about like toughening up their children. They supposedly, if babies are born in the winter, they bring them outside to just like hang out outside and get their lungs ready. So to me, that's a little alarming that they're bringing their Soviet parenting principles here.
Isn't that how you Midwestern children were raised?
Yes, but we don't talk about it.
Right. We're ashamed of it. So here's where we need my friend Dan. This is where the story shifts a little bit. So you're watching these guys on TV. You know, they're Tacoma Park parents, which where Dan is from, which to the rest of the nation translates into Portland parents, right? Like the 10-year-old has an earring. The dad has that like Portlandia bike messenger goatee. They're face-to-face with a Fox News reporter.
I have to tell you, I think that if I had kids your age, I would be really nervous, especially with my job and seeing the dangers that are out there. So what do you say to people watching this that are saying, what are they thinking? These kids are too small.
To remember that just because you saw it once on the news doesn't mean that it's happening every day in every town, everywhere. The scary things that you hear are extremely rare. And there is not a stranger everywhere looking to abduct you. Yes, things like the sex offender registries are scary. Most children, unfortunately, in those situations are hurt by people they know. It's not strangers.
What do you guys think? Do you like walking around by yourself?
Yeah, we do.
You feel safe?
Yeah, we do.
Yeah, and you feel safe looking out for your little sister?
Yeah, I feel totally independent. I feel free, and I feel very safe.
So what happens in these exchanges is that this couple, the Métis, they sound so rational, and, you know, they're expressing their principles, but then suddenly it switches and you feel like you're listening to someone on Portlandia explain why we should all be eating kale and worrying about antioxidants. Like, it's so rational and it's so sort of science-based, and yet the Fox News reporter is saying, like, what? You let your children do what? Like, the Fox News reporter comes to represent the normal person reaction or the emotional reaction, which is, okay, you can talk to me from here until tomorrow about what I should be doing and the safety rates and how crime has gone down, but I it's just like blah, 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 blah. I can't hear you, which is what I feel is happening in the world. We talk about this and we talk about this, but parents can't seem to shift. So Dan, I'm going to introduce you here because Dan is a psychologist. He works in Silver Spring, exactly where these guys were walking. He deals with children and families. And Dan, so a family comes into your office and you have the feeling that they've got this like noose on their kid. Like, you have a feeling this is a family you could help by teaching them to become a little more free range. Can you describe the scenario or the barriers that come up?
Yeah, first I would just like to say that I think Tacoma Park is more dedicated and loyal to the principles of pure communism, not
Yes, so, okay, wonderful.
The thing that I responded most to was the outcry of how everyone should be doing this. And there's a typical thing that happens is that most people begin to think about their childhood, and boomers and probably Xers to some degree have a very idyllic, you know, memory of that. But I think that what happens is that there's a push and a pull. The push is the memories of their childhood, and the mom in this case talked about that she wanted to be able to give her kids the childhood that she had. And then there's the pull. There's a sense that if I don't do this with my kids, if I don't give them more responsibility or autonomy, there's a good chance of what I like to refer to as subterraneous adultus, which is a 25-year-old who's back living in your basement after college playing Minecraft. And there's the both of those things, but parents, so there's a, I think, a sense on both sides that this is something we should be doing. It's something that we want to do, but they're also between a rock and a hard place.
Because why? Like, what prevents them? Is it just literally, it's fear? They're just afraid? You know, they want to espouse, because I've seen this a million times. Like, when I wrote this blog post, I got emails from all sorts of parents that I know saying to me, like, you go, girl, like, hell yes, we should let them roam free. And I know these parents, and I know perfectly well that they would never let their kids cross the street alone if their life depended on it. And yet they're like all of my best friends. So what is the gap there?
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is that it's the easiest thing in the world to do is to criticize somebody else's parenting. And I think kind of like the French Resistance, as many people were in the French Resistance and say they were, they should have gotten the Nazis out in about 2 weeks. There are not that many parents that are able to execute this thing. And the primary thing is there are shifting cultural values.
So how do you do it? So how do you walk a parent if you feel that it's necessary? Like, let's say they're coming to you and the kid's about to be a teenager, you know, the kid's not 6 years old, and you feel like they are still using the tools they used, but those tools are not necessary or even detrimental. How do you do it? Like, how do you convince people? Because as Dan pointed out to me, Lenore Skenazy, who's the mother of the free range parenting movement, has a new Discovery Life show. It's kind of like a reality show where she does what I am asking Dan to explain to us, the Free Range Kids Project. And she's going to try and teach parents who have this reluctance, which so many parents do, to actually try it. Right. So what are the rules for trying it for all our listeners there? Like, what is it you have to get over? Is it about being honest with yourself about what's helping and not helping? Like, what would you tell people?
I think probably the most convincing argument is, if you've established any credibility with the parents, is to be able to get them to appreciate that what we're about to embark on is really in the kid's best interest.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about it, these folks have been high-impact parents. They've been really lean in and trying to do the best to their kids' advantage. And this is a bit of a course change. It's not a reversal, but it's an adjustment. And it's about making something that really continues to be in their kids' advantage. It's a different type of change. It's not a bigger hammer. And that's the tough part. The bigger hammer piece, or just steady as she goes, is the more natural thing. You know, like, we're all creatures of habit. We like to do what we are good at, what we know how to do. And this in some ways, is really sort of almost a defiance of that.
Can I just give some pushback here, though? Because I'm now stating a position that I don't entirely believe, because I should confess my own biases, which is that I was so much overprotected that I suspect that's why I now, and for many years, have lived 3,000 miles away from my parents, because I wasn't even allowed to cross the road after a certain point. And still now, my mom, even though I could be a grandmother, my mom really doesn't like me to cross the road on my own when I go home. But we see among the stories that we read, the Métis have at their fingertips the facts like 300 kids a day are injured in car accidents, whereas since 1993, the number of children younger than 13 who've been murdered is down 36%. Kids 14 to 17, down 60%. All of that. Well, I'm wondering if that is because now kids don't go out. I mean, you said a little while earlier, Hannah, back in the glory days, or the happy
1972,
ages of 1972. Well, that also is when those figures were 36% up and 60% up, when there was more trouble. I mean, do we actually have a state of affairs where we're actually, things are much better for children right now? This independence, you know, we keep hearing all these stories of grit and that damn marshmallow test. Sure, sure. But are we actually better off now? Also, it seems to me that this is just another form of helicopter parenting. You know, yes, it's, you know, it depends how you define helicopter parenting. But if it's all about, like, controlling every single variant to try and give your kids the best outcome by their lights, they're just doing that now. So it's just another form of helicopter parenting.
Oh my God, that's so disturbing. So I would say no to the first one and yes to the second one. No to the first one, because all crime is down. It's like that Steven Pinker story that ran its late. It's not that crime against children particularly it's down. It's just that mysteriously you know, after a long series of recessions, for reasons nobody can adequately explain, we have a lot less crime. We're in a sort of crime phase of the 50s. I have no idea why, you know, and that child murders have moved to car. It's like we all have to collectively decide to just stop driving kids everywhere. And then the car accidents will fall. But so it is mysterious, but I think it is actually real, the drop in crimes. The second one is a really disturbing point you make, June, that like we all, the only way we can convince parents or talk to parents, we're so trapped in this idiom of enrichment and kind of hovery parenting that we can only conceive of anti-hovering as yet another hovering mechanism. You should stop hovering so that your children could be even smarter and better than the other children whose parents hover.
Well,
you know?
Can I just say that the name free-range parenting really turns me off?
Yeah.
It's so...
Like a chicken?
Well, okay, follow that metaphor all the way. It's a chicken who dies, right? They need to think about what they're putting forth. It's a chicken who dies. But also just on a visceral level, it's so stupid and artisanal. And it, you know, it just makes me think about the sort of fussy parents who I don't necessarily want to align myself with.
Well, I think evolution wires, parents and particularly moms to be so tuned in ways when they perceive threat. I think it's about managing the sense of threat. The thing that I think happened with this is that the narrative gets kind of hijacked that like, okay, this is a reactive movement. Like there's helicopter parenting and like nobody wants to be associated with that. So we all jump to this other ship or you know, some of us jump this other ship. And the sense is that that's the reaction and it has to be sort of an all or none. The key thing with all of this stuff, with behavior change in general, is incremental change, is being able to make small goals and steps. And it is a good thing. You know, autonomy is a good thing. Having your kid be able to problem solve, have them be able to deal with their own feelings and emotions if things are not going well, those are all desirable, parental goals for your kid. So, whether I think that it gets framed in a particular way, and then it seems like that describes the whole endeavor, but there are a lot of ways toward what I think free range points to. But I think it points to something worthwhile and worth trying, even though it's very difficult.
Dan, thank you. I think the ultimate advice we have is everyone who's nervous should go to Dan's office and see Dan, and he will help them become the exact amount of free range. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Now let's move on to our second topic, the trick to falling in love. But before we do that, we are going to hear about our sponsor, Squarespace. June?
The XX GabFest is brought to you by Squarespace, which recently launched the latest version of its platform, Squarespace 7. It has a completely redesigned interface, integrations with Getty Images and Google Apps, new templates, and an incredible feature called Cover Pages. And right now, XX listeners can get a special offer, 10% off your first purchase when you go to squarespace.com and use the offer code XX. Before products like Squarespace, creating a website was really challenging and the results could be disappointing, especially if, like me, you work at a website where you have all these people behind the scenes making it a piece of cake, and then you think it's going to be like that everywhere, and it really isn't. But Squarespace makes it much more like being at a magazine like Slate, where you have lots of drag and drop sort of elements that you can put together, and you can make a website that looks super professional without really any skills yourself. So Squarespace makes building a simple and powerful website easy with 24/7 support via live chat and email. Your site will look great, all for $8 a month. You can start a trial with no credit card required. And remember, go to squarespace.com and show your support for our podcast and get 10% off your first purchase with the offer code XX. Just go to squarespace.com and get the special offer by using the offer code DOUBLEX. Back to you, Hannah.
Now let's move on to our second topic. Can you will someone to fall in love? 20 years ago, psychologist Arthur Aaron did an experiment. He had a man and a woman who didn't know each other sit face to face and answer a series of increasingly personal questions, starting with things like, who would you want as a dinner guest? Would you like to be famous? Moving on to, when did you last sing? And making his way all the way to, when did you last cry in front of another person? The idea is that mutual vulnerability, or what Aaron describes as sustained, escalating, reciprocal personal self-disclosure, would lead to love. As a final exercise, they stare silently into each other's eyes for 4 minutes. In a recent Modern Love column, Mandy Lynn Cantrone described how she tried this experiment and not only fell in love, but stayed in love and married the man she was on a date with at the time. So, Noreen, get going, man. Like, what are you waiting for? Like, put those 36 questions in your pocket and get on a bar stool.
I want someone to try going on an internet date and asking these questions. And just how creeped out would the person be?
Really? Yeah. I was thinking you could start a dating. We, the three of us right now, should start a dating service called the 36 Questions. And instead of doing speed dating, you would just do this. Like, you would carve out 2 hours. People would ask each other, because then you get rid of the creep factor, because it's kind of, you know, it's like sanctioned by the institution called 36 Questions.
That's actually a good business plan, and we should get off the air now and do it. but these are aggressive questions. These are like, you know, I mean, some of them are stupid and you could ask them on date number one, like, you know, who's at your dream dinner party? Like, who cares? That doesn't reveal anything super deep about you. But some of them are basically asking you to reveal your sort of deepest fears and deepest anxieties. And that is, you know, some people go through a whole marriage and never really reveal those things.
Right. That was the thing that struck me that, I mean, at first, I thought to myself, is this just a recipe for dishonesty? Because there are certain things that, like, I do not want people to know until they know much more about me, because they're my worst aspects that are revealed in the answers to these questions if I tell the truth.
Like, which ones?
Oh, sure. Let me just tell you my worst aspect. Uh-huh. Let's just say my relationship with my mother may not be the healthiest in the world. And I, like, if somebody needs to overhear me having a Skype conversation with my mom to see my worst self, not hear about it in the first time we
But doesn't meet. It deflect with self-awareness that you know, this is like what you want to fix about yourself, kind of?
I don't want to fix it. It's just like, it's just how it is.
So this is such a funny stylistic difference because, or maybe personality difference. I read these 36 questions and I was like, that's all you want to know? Like, that's it? That's so boring. Like, ask me a real question, honey.
Oh, my God.
Wait, really? I thought these
yes.
were quite prying.
Quite prying.
Well, so here's the thing. I think, you know, I was thinking to myself in a confessional age where, I mean, I feel like people say everything on it. You know, people write. If you want to know my deepest secrets, just read my Modern Love column read my Twitter feed. It's like people are not that shy about confessing. So I was thinking, you know, this experiment was done in the 70s when we were not yet in the hyper-confessional age. And so it would have a different purpose in the 70s than it would now. Now, the continuous prying, you would need 36 questions to get past the self-presentation. You know, that at a first date would involve so much kind of confessional self-presentation that you'd have to push and push and push until you got to some real emotion, like past the, you know, yes, I wrote a book about how I tried to kill my own mother, and you would just give that speech to your date. But that
just for the record, that is not something that I did.
but wait, Hannah, I do think that these questions push you past the sort of surface level, like, okay, here's how I construct myself. Like, I'm such a damaged free spirit, but like these push past that, or, you know, or I'm such a sweet, placid person. They push past that, I think.
Like what? Your relationship with your mother? I mean,
no,
who doesn't talk
one.
About that on a first date? It's like,
not that one.
Well, but I think, actually, it is just the variety. Like,
well, does anyone, Hannah, do you have them in front of you? Could you?
I sure do, okay. Because you know what I did last night while getting bored with the State of the Union? I made David answer these questions. And he and I did this because it occurred to me that actually this has a purpose in marriage, not just in first date, because, you know, you reach a point of many years of marriage when you just kind of, the person becomes routine to you. So I just, as a personal experiment, and partly also because State of the Union, as we said, are inherently boring, after a while, and I was just like kind of prepping for the podcast, we started asking each other the question, and it was like kind of beautiful.
Did you stare into each other's eyes for 4 minutes?
You know, we forgot to do that.
Yeah, that's the important part.
I know. I really want David to do that. But, like, for example, there was one where you have to say something about each other. Mm-hmm. That's the one that really was moving. It was like, tell your partner what you like about them. Be very honest this time, saying things that you might not say to someone you just met. Now, David and I have not just met, but you rarely do you sit down with the person you're married to and tell them 5 things that you really like about them. Mm-hmm. That's like a touching thing to do,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Well, tell us some that are more that make you say more negative things about yourself.
When did you last cry in front of another person or by yourself? Okay, so that to me feels like that's getting a little touchy, right? I was really depressed last week because, like, do you necessarily want someone you're on a first date to sort of go immediately to that side of yourself?
See, you know? Both Noreen and I are kind of shrugging as you say that, like, which to me reveals that we each have something that seems very personal and like something we want to guard closely. And it's not the same all around. So you need this 36 questions to kind of cover all the bases. Y'all don't care about your relationship with your mother because it's great. So you have no problems relating that. However, I'm happy to talk about the last time I cried because it was never bitches. And we each have our thing. But so you need the full spectrum just to get to everybody's sore spot.
All right, I want to get to Noreen's.
Yeah, okay. I'm staring at you.
I cried like 2 weeks ago in the bathroom at work, just so everyone knows. Very stressful time at work.
Okay. I'm sure you don't want to talk about that on the air. So there's like 35 of all the here's 34. Your house containing everything you own catches fire. After saving your loved ones and pets, you have time to safely make a final dash to save one item. What would it be and why? That to me is like a nothing question.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
That's like a Proust questionnaire question. Laptop, obviously.
Television, obviously. Cable box, TiVo box, hello. It's got my season passes registered on it.
I don't know nice things. No, maybe like a family photo, but, you know, I've got negative.
These days, exactly. It's on your phone already.
Yeah.
Share with your partner an embarrassing moment in your life. That's not so hard. You could
if you've been with me for 5 minutes, that's happened.
Yeah. Oh,
here's
God.
Now, one thing that struck me, I mean, first of all, what's clear is that you have to be in the right mind space. You have to be looking to make that connection. That's the essential ingredient. Because honestly, if you are kind of whatever the person says, if you're up for it, that is so much more important than not really being up for it. Nothing's going to fool you into falling in love.
Well, that's what I was thinking, why this original experiment became the stuff of romantic comedy and lived on in people's minds is because one of the couples that did the experiment actually ended up being married. Mm. And I think that confused in people's minds the act of falling in love and the act of staying in love, which are two very different things. So the act of falling in love, I think, is aided by the sense that the person, you know, so in this experiment, they kind of they said to people, we are choosing this person for you. So they acted as matchmakers. And I think in people's heads, the process of falling in love can be greatly aided by a sense of destiny. So the destiny can be algorithm, the way it is with many dating sites, or it can be like a matchmaker, or it can be like, you know, the wizard behind the curtain. I don't even think it matters, but just that people have a sense, okay, it's fairly safe because it's two college students. They're on the college campus. You know, my professor man thinks we are made for each other based on something that questions we answered. And I think that's likely to aid the like look into each other's eyes process a lot. But then the fact that one got married really probably has nothing to do with it, you know?
I also think that there is something to what they call mutual vulnerability, but it's not even just the mutual part. It's the idea that I think human beings are sort of essentially selfish. And if you have found someone that you can reveal this to, that makes you fall in love with them. It's not what they're telling you. It's what you're telling them. It's that you feel like they are now in your inner circle and you've now exposed yourself to them and they still have kept coming back for more questions. I think there's just something about that is important.
There was something to that. You know, when I was – he said I could say this. When I was having coffee with Dan this morning before the show, he said that actually he and his wife – met in a very similar way. They were at a retreat and they had to do this exercise and they had never met before. And he said what it required in his case was the listening. You had to kind of listen and be extremely present. That was the exercise. It's like a mirroring thing or something. Like you just had to really listen to the person's answer. And he feels it's that shifted the dynamic more than anything else. Like the fact that you had this like sympathetic and very present listener to your outpouring.
One thing that I was surprised, that was not mentioned at all was just a sense of mutual attraction. I mean, I tend to think that can be overrated or overstressed, but it does need to be present in some way. There has to be something that you fancy about the person. And again, the person who wrote the modern love story kind of confessed that there was already a slight spark, like there was a possibility between the two of them. But it seems odd to me to just ignore that completely.
Well, it doesn't. It's got the
science.
It's got the 4 minutes eyes thing at the end. I mean, that seems silly, but every human being in the world really does have beautiful eyes if you look at them. And then if you look at them for 4 minutes, you have 4 minutes to think about the particularities of this person's eyes.
But it's funny, though, because they have to be heterosexual. I mean, the way that you talk about, you know, if that's true, then you could stare into anybody's eyes. You could stare, if you were heterosexual, you could stare into...
Oh, yeah. Well, I think there's a baseline assumption that this person is within the, like, range of people that you are attracted to.
And speaking of homosexuals, it strikes me that at least until, I don't know today, but until at least a few years ago, there always was that sort of shared vulnerability, because when you met, if you were, like me, a lesbian, when you went on a first date, you would often have that kind of, you know, does your mother know? Are you out to X? And there was this kind of sharing of, you know, relatively personal, private stuff that this test is designed to reveal, that I think maybe is maybe one ingredient in the accelerated courtship of lesbians.
You know, I often think, June, about whether the new age of openness has destroyed the coming out story, which is so central to many people's identity. And now you just, you know, spoke about another place in which it's central to kind of connection and vulnerability, because that's not necessarily even a story, I think, as time goes on. You just, you know, you're gay, I'm heterosexual. It's just not that big a deal.
Right.
And so it's something that bonds the community that's not there.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I just want to say I don't necessarily think the new age of openness has extended to dating. I think for a lot of people who especially people who do online dating, early dates feel more like a resume dump. Huh. And this is like a refreshing counter to that. And like you just sit there across the table from someone and talk about where you went to college, which is not going to bring you any closer. But it's just like sort of the baseline thing that you have to do.
So how do you get, isn't the mark of a good date, like when you come home and think you've had a date, it was good because there was some connection that's beyond what you're just describing.
Totally.
Right? So what opens up the space for that connection? Forget the 36 questions. Say they're an artificial way to open up the space. And I think that's why they're still useful, because if you got people to do this, you would force that space to open. But what else makes it? Like you come upon a topic that's, you know, mutual, and that leads you into unexpected places, and suddenly you're in, you know, emotional vulnerable territory? Or is it you just have to get to the real emotion somehow?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same as just like small talk with a new friend. Anytime you get beyond it, it's good, you know. And then like with a date, if you're attracted to them, that helps too. I don't know, you guys have been on dates.
Poor Noreen, we always put her on the spot in these date moments. Last thing I want to say, there's a wonderful This American Life story by Nazanin Rafsanjani, who is a producer who's worked in radio and TV, also happens to be married to Alex Bloomberg of the Startup Podcast. And it's about her parents and essentially the two ways they've met. One is as an arranged marriage, and the other is they came back together. They got divorced, broke up, and came back together. But it's their process of re-getting to know each other and becoming intimate. They were intimate in this kind of, you know, I wouldn't say fake way, but it's like they were married and yet never got to ask each other these questions, though they were married for many, many years. And then they got married in what Rafsanjani describes as the American way, where they sit down and have this conversation and ask each other these lots of questions and get to know each other again. So it's quite a beautiful story.
Awesome.
Now let's move on to our third topic, Broad City. But before we do that, we want to hear from our second sponsor, Harry's. June, take it away.
Well, yes, the XX Gabfest is this week sponsored by Harry's, the razor company we've talked about here on the show several times. With Harry's, you can go online to buy quality razors, handles, and shaving cream or gel, all for a fraction of the price that you'd pay at the drugstore. And you don't have to, you know, go and get someone to get them from behind the special cabinet of blades. So much simpler and less fraught. This Valentine's Day, Harry's is here to help you find the perfect gift and avoid those tacky Valentine's Day cliches. This year, consider giving your Valentine the Chrome Winston razor with free engraving. That's right. You can get stuff engraved on this cool chrome razor, and it's an amazing deal. So if you go to harrys.com now, you can get a free $15 engraving on their Chrome Winston set with code XXValentine on your first purchase. You can save $15 and get the chrome engraved Winston set for just $25. I will also mention that it comes with three blades and your choice of Harry's shaving cream or foaming shave gel. Foaming shave gel, that sounds ever so exciting.
I know, I just really wish I could get the engraved one for David. I'm thinking about it because he loves his Harry's business. Mm-hmm. He loves it now and has become increasingly addicted to it. And he has a birthday coming up. But do you think if the guy already has a Harry's razor, can you get him the engraved one? Is that extra awesome?
Sorry, Hannah. The offer is for first-time customers only.
Oh, bummer. Okay.
But if you are a first-time customer, you can take advantage of this fabulous offer. Just go to harrys.com and get this great offer with the code XXValentine. That's D-O-U-B-L-E-X, Valentine. That's harrys.com and enter the coupon code XXValentine. Thank you so much, harrys.com, for sponsoring us.
Okay, let's talk about Broad City. Broad City is a show on Comedy Central about two girl slackers in New York, and it's just started its second season. The show revolves around two friends, Abby and Alana, who roam around New York stealing stuff, smoking pot, striving in some vague but megalomaniacal way to be famous, but mostly being horny, talking about being horny, and so far in the second season, even raping someone. So a few people were baffled by the first season. I recall an Alessandra Stanley review in which she called it like a draft, basically a poorly typed treatment. But over time, many people got more enthusiastic and they've since developed a rabid fan base. So far in the second season, the show's gotten more polished, funnier, and more beloved. There's been two episodes so far, and we are going to talk about the first one. But before we do it, let's listen to this clip. In this clip, Seth Rogen, who plays Abby's date, is over at the apartment. He's cooking fajitas. It's an incredibly hot day. He's sort of at the hot stove, and they've been getting it on, kind of on and off. Or you kind of know they're going to get it on just because that's what happens in the show all the time.
He's cooking her dinner.
Annie's cooking her dinner. Just the whole scene is just like obvious. You know, it's obvious. It's not like they're smooth operators, even either of them.
No.
But something, you know, they're always getting on. So then they sort of start having sex. It's really, really hot in the apartment. He's really sweaty and he faints. And yet Abby finishes. As she keeps saying, she finishes. And then she decides afterwards that she is a rapist. So let's listen to the clip where Abby agonizes about whether she's a rapist.
So to clarify, you raped... Ooh, you raped him. No. He passed out from the heat. He seriously wanted it. Ooh, that is literally what they say.
Yeah, but I really mean it.
So do they.
Well, dude... Did you finish?
God, I raped him, dude. I raped Mel Stacey. I'm a monster. I need an air conditioner immediately.
Wow.
So why are they allowed to say something like this? And why is it funny?
Well, because maybe it wasn't really a rape. I mean, the way that the scene plays out, it stops once he passes out. She sort of is like, what? Wake up, you know, and it wasn't like an intentional thing that she did.
I know, but like imagine if a girl was passed out and the guy finishes, as she puts it, you know, she doesn't really know what's going on. So it's like, you know, it's the same situation. He doesn't know what's going on. So like, what's the, you know, it's true. They're like digging at something here. It's totally interesting. And it's like Louis C.K., right? It's like funny, but kind of uncomfortably funny. But yet because of who they are and their particular sensibility, they get away with it. You know, he gets away with a lot of stuff that other comedians don't get away with.
I don't think it's quite like the Louis C.K. thing. In the Louis C.K. thing, Louis C.K. was saying no all the way, and Seth Rogen was consenting here. I can't believe we're debating this, but it is just a funny scene, and the funniest part is her earnest reaction, right? Like, she is reacting with all of the good liberal sentiments of someone who is very against rape culture. I think they're like taking a piss out of that a little bit, while also recognizing that it's a real problem, they somehow are able to skirt that line.
Always. That's what's amazing about the show. Like, yeah. Abby's not exactly the straight man, right? She's
no.
not really Alana's the one who has no conscience in the end of by the way, before we get into this, I will say we kind of have to talk about some details and instances on the show in order to have this conversation properly. I'm not even sure if you could call them spoilers because the show doesn't have a narrative arc. You know, mm-hmm. It's not like in Girls where you're wondering, like, you know, in the early seasons, like, is Hannah going to end up with Adam or not get with Adam? It's a little more like sketch comedy. So we might be talking about the way a particular sketch ends or an episode ends. But is that fair, guys? Like, it's not a narrative, right?
Right. It's very hard to think of spoilers on Broad City, even though there is kind of a narrative to it. It's not in a sense that it could really be spoiled, I don't think.
Yeah, like what I was going to say is that Alana, at the end of the second season first episode, the one that aired a week ago, she's, you know, they're walking through the subway again. It's that same hot day. And they end up in a subway car with a lot of Hasidic men. And at the end of it, she slaps one of them on the ass, you know? So like that's the sense in which Abby wouldn't do that. Abby wouldn't do that because she's like got more of a conscience and she's supposed to represent the good girl, you know? Right. But representing the good girl means like putting a post-it on her vibrator that says, you know, don't forget to masturbate. Like, that's the way in which she's the good girl.
Yeah, and it's really interesting how things go wrong. Like, it's funny, I keep reading stories that say that young women really relate to them, and I wonder if it's quite relating or if there's an element of wish fulfillment or if it's kind of that they take risks and bad things happen to them, but they're not really bad. Like, everything goes wrong, but nothing is too terrible as a consequence.
I think people relate to them. I relate to them, which you may not believe. No, but they're a little gross in a way
yes.
that people really are. And people like to pretend that women aren't. But, you know, they call each other dude. There's an episode, I think it's the most recent one that aired, where Abby's roommate's boyfriend, who's always around, his name is Bevers. The big joke is that you never see her roommate, you only see the boyfriend. Her roommate's out of town, and all she wants to do is like dance around naked.
Her roommate's like saving people in Haiti. Like, she's like a ridiculous
yeah.
caricature of an awesome, you know, kind of righteous person. Yeah,
yeah. I just think there's something about the way they like consume food and intoxicants and just want to hang is really kind of, without, you know, without getting too down and mopey about all of it, feels super familiar. Like there's a great line in the Rachel Syme piece on Grantland about Broad City, which is a fantastic piece of profile
Fantastic.
Writing that everyone should go read. And this show gets compared to Girls a lot because mm-hmm. it's about, you know, young white women in New York City. And she says, on sort of a parenthetical aside, that, okay, let's just dispense with this right away. Girls is this gray kind of depressionscape about all the difficulties of being young. And Broad City is this cartoonish, animated thing. And that's what it is. It's a cartoonish version yeah. that somehow feels more, they feel more like people I actually know.
Can I read just a quote from Glazer because it's so apt to what Noreen just said? Mm-hmm. I think this is in the New Yorker profile, not in the Grantland profile.
Also great.
Yeah.
Yeah, also another great one by Nick Palmgarten. Every girl I know shits and talks about it and fucks and talks about it. And people are like, these women are filthy. And I'm like, not compared to my friends. The show may be a cartoon version of us, but the cartoon sometimes gets closer to reality than anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, because for me, it's so funny, Noreen, because I think of you as so you're not like this, right?
Right.
But yet somehow you relate to them. Like you have more, what, gracious, I would say. Like you don't walk around the world like a fuck up.
I'm not Alana Glazer. I'm not Alana Glazer. But I recognize her and I think she's fun to hang out with.
Now, is it wish fulfillment? I mean,
No, I don't know how to explain it.
Yeah, because like you work a lot. They don't really put much time or effort into work. I mean, Abby would like to, but is it that they're doing?
Yeah, but like I certainly spent some hungover Saturdays in my 20s where I was just kind of rolling around doing nothing. And I think that's what it represents. It's an exaggerated version of these moments that you have in your 20s where you are beholden to absolutely no one. And
You know, I was always wondering why the women, the young women who are famous in the last few years or have TV shows, this includes Lena Dunham, this includes these guys, this includes Greta Gerwig, that their film representation is so much more slacker and screw up than themselves, right? Like, it's a version of themselves, and yet it's the screw up version of themselves. So almost all the profiles of these girls make the comparison between how hard they actually work and what their working life is like, how they sit side by side in laptops, you know, their creative process, they get into that, how much they've worked sort of even through their 20s in stand-up comedy, and how ambitious they are, but in a serious way, you know, having started with the YouTube show and then extended to the Real Show. And yet their portrayal is not at all like that. Now, is that a sexist question to ask because men have been portraying slackers time immemorial and nobody cares? Or is that a real question to ask?
Well, I think just as a if you're a super driven person, the moments when you are just hanging out on your couch probably loom large in your mind, either because you're mad at yourself for not, you know, working in that moment, or because they're sort of great for you. And so I think, like, it makes sense that all of those women would draw some creative juices from these lulls.
June, do you think there's some feminist revenge in it? You know what I mean? Like, that you know, guys have been allowed to be slackers on TV and swear and curse and be screw-ups like that movie Bridesmaids, you know, when they're just, like, filthy as all get out, or, like, being scatological. You know, that's something women get to do, too?
I guess. I mean, I think I remember years ago, like, seeing somebody on television say to Lily Tomlin, you know, what's great about you is you're not afraid to make yourself ugly. And she just kind of pulled her face and said, ah, thanks. You know, and that's kind of a weird thing to say to someone, but it is key for, like, female comics or women who are being funny. You know, these women, that is to say, Ilana and Abby, are absolutely fearless. There's a moment in season one where Abby, who has a crush, a weird crush that she can't really even say anything about to a guy who lives on her hallway, she goes to ridiculous lengths to pick up a parcel for him. And it's this fantastic set piece, but it's also kind of debasing herself. But she always comes off better when she kind of admits these things. And there's something about that, their willingness to express those kind of down moments, that I think are more powerful somehow for a woman. And I also think that it is interesting that people like Lena Dunham and Abby and Ilana really are doing so much themselves. It's not just a song. It's significant that...
What do you mean, doing so much themselves? Like creating their own shows?
Creating their own shows, and not just creating them, but certainly in the case of Broad City, you know, reading these great profiles, they kind of do everything. You know, they not only write them, they edit them, they are so completely central. Now, I don't mean to exaggerate that. I don't think they're not trying to take credit for everything, but they are hugely involved. And that doesn't seem to me to be coincidental or insignificant. I don't mean to keep harping on this thing of, like, they are, you know, role models or something, but they kind of are role models. It's awesome. And also, let's just not forget, this show is just crazy funny.
Yeah.
To me, what's great about it is that it doesn't seem like they are thinking that much about how much they're transgressing. And what was kind of annoying about the Bridesmaids era was how much we were being told how great it was that women were being bawdy and, like, women could make these dirty jokes too. And it was like, stop hitting me over the head with it. You know, there was a famous scene where the girl shits herself in the bridesmaid's dress, which actually was added by, I think, Judd Apatow, you know. But what is funny about these characters is just, I don't think they thought about it like, okay, we're going to create a really transgressive character here. They just exaggerated their own characters. They happen to be women, but, like, both Abby and Ilana have these very clear psychologies, and that's what's funny, is they just take them to the edge. Like, Abby has a tramp stamp of Oprah that says everything about Abby, and Ilana wears crop tops to work all the time and doesn't think it's a problem, you know.
Can we talk about their friendship? Because I think I wake up in the morning, not something you should admit, and I think to myself, like, please don't let Abby and Ilana ever break up or Key and Peele ever break up. Like, the friendships is like, I think Amanda has called it a superpower. It is a kind of superpower on the show. It's a friendship that I think is just perfect and awesome. Like, it's not the kind of friendship you usually see where people are trying to make each other better people. You know, it's a friendship of total acceptance. I mean, Abby fakely tries to make everybody better, but really they just accept each other as they are. And you see that in the second season. It was at the end of the show aired last night when they talk about pregnancy, you know, like when I give birth and I shit myself and you're just going to be there in the room with me. You know, she doesn't like hand her tips for a better birth or anything like that. It's just like, that's how it is. And we will always be there for each other. I think it's just beautiful.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we all agree that all of our listeners should just watch all of Broad City all the time and then come back and tell us what they think about it, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's move on to our recommendations. June, do you want to go first?
Yes, I actually have two. One very quickly, which is FX just started a new show last week called Man Seeking Woman, which feels to me in a weird way kind of like a male version of Broad City. It's not an exact parallel, but it feels similar in that there are sort of non-realistic elements. At times, the show feels like there are kind of live-action people in the middle of a cartoon. And so in that sense, it feels somewhat parallel to Broad City, although also quite different. And it's Jay Baruchel and Eric Andre are the sort of the main people in it. And I just find it super interesting. And it's written by Simon Rich. It's very worth your time. Might not be for everyone, but it's to me an interesting show. And then the other thing I want to mention is that on the 28th of January, next Wednesday, The Americans comes back for season 3, and I've seen the first 4 episodes, and oh my God, episode 3 has a scene that will be the scene of the year. This is a show, if you haven't been on board, you can start over on season 3, and it is not to be missed. And just a quick disclaimer, The Americans was created by Joe Weisberg, who is the brother of Jacob Weisberg, who is the editor-in-chief of the Slate Group. But that is just a FURI because it is a magnificent show.
Man, our readers are going to be watching, listeners are going to be watching so much television, they won't have time to listen to our show.
Good work, people.
Okay, my turn. Two things also. First, I want to recommend Invisibilia is a new NPR podcast about the hidden emotions and psychology that shapes our lives. It is created by two people. One of them is my very, very good friend, Elise Spiegel. Stories include one about a blind man who rides a bicycle, a woman who doesn't feel fear, and then what these outliers teach us about ourselves. It is fantastic storytelling and incredibly smart. The second one I want to recommend is something called the I Survived series. My children and I have been gobbling this up. I never heard of these books, and then I took them out of the library, and I cannot get enough of them. They were written by a woman named Lauren Tarshis, T-A-R-S-H-I-S, and she places children, generally boys who are about 10 or 11, in catastrophic situations, like in September 11th or the Nazi invasion or Hurricane Katrina. And for kids who love adventure stories or disaster stories, which my sons do, they are just so fantastically told. Like, I've never seen learning history done quite this well. And my son and I wrote her a long email, and he asked her the question, why are they always boys? And then she wrote this very moving answer back. And anyway, I'm just in love with this whole series. Wow. Noreen.
I'm going to recommend a book that has been recommended in all the usual places. The Empathy Exams by Leslie Jameson, which was a big sort of small press sleeper hit last year. And I sort of wrestled with this book because I have a very different sensibility than the author. And a lot of what she's writing about is her own sensibility and her way of being a woman in the world. And, you know, her sort of lodestones are not mine. She's very into Susan Sontag and Sylvia Plath and all these people who sort of reckon, in particular, people like Plath who reckon with female weakness. And I am and just that stuff normally turns me off. But she investigates what it is about that kind of thing that turns people off. In particular, there's one essay, the first and the last essays in the book. If you only read those two, I believe they're available online. But the last essay is called A Grand Theory of Unified Pain, where she's sort of talking to people like me who are like, can we stop, you know, putting ourselves as women in the position to sort of read as weak and victims and et cetera. And she sort of has an answer to people like me. And it's worth reading.
I love that book, too. I'm with you on that one. Well, thank you both. We'd also like to thank our producer, Anne Hepperman, the managing producer of Slate Podcast, Joel Meyer, executive producer, Andy Bowers. For more information about our show, go to our show page, slate.com/XX. You can also go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/XXGabFest, spelled out. Tell us what you think about this show, what you'd like us to discuss. You can always email us at XXGabFest@slate.com and subscribe on iTunes so other people can find out about the show. For June and Noreen, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we'll be back in 2 weeks.